How many of you remember where you were on December the 7th, 1941? No? Seriously. It's kind of a generational thing. How many of you remember where you were on September the 11th, 2001? I know we do have some World War II veterans in our congregation. Or some of you who were living at the time. But the Day of Infamy, as President Roosevelt referred to it, and a very significant date in our history. And on this Sabbath, December the 7th, it's worth at least remembering that some of those historic events that maybe precede the generation for most of us certainly were very significant and very meaningful. And when you look back at that time period following and the events of World War II, certainly God had a hand in those events as they unfolded to continue to bless this nation. And it was really during and after World War II that the United States reached the very pinnacle of its influence and power in world politics and military and economy. It was a very important period of time in our history. Well, I want to talk about history today, not so much about World War II, but I want to go back to a time much earlier than that. But I do want to talk about some history and how it is significant to us and how it was significant as it was unfolding. The Jewish community, just a couple of days ago, completed their annual celebration of Hanukkah. It's a festival that's also known by other names, such as the Feast of Lights and the Feast of Dedication. It started this year on November the 27th at sunset, and it was completed just on Thursday, December the 5th, at sunset. Hanukkah is not a holiday that we observe. It's not one that we probably know a lot about. I'm sure you're aware of some of the basics of the day. Probably a lot of us don't know anything more about it than what we have learned from Adam Sandler's song. Some of you don't know who Adam Sandler is. That's not a problem at all, believe me. But you know, when we learn a little bit about this particular festival, it really has an origin that is historic in nature. It's not pagan. It really wouldn't be wrong to acknowledge the events and to, in some ways, recognize that period of time, the 8 days of Hanukkah. In fact, one of the gospel accounts shows that Jesus Christ was in Jerusalem as that festival was being observed. Now, it does not say that he was observing the festival, but it does at least acknowledge that time and Jesus' presence in Jerusalem while the festival of dedication, as it's also known, was being celebrated. But of course, given that Jesus grew up in a Jewish household not too far from Jerusalem, chances are that it was something that he and his family did observe as a tradition as he was growing up. Well, today I want to take some time to review and consider with you some of the background of this festival. As I said, it's also known as the Feast of Lights or the Festival of Dedication. The story is an interesting one. It's a story of tragedy, and it's a story of victory. And the events that took place that led to that annual celebration were prophesied hundreds of years before it occurred. And what's really fascinating is that it is a story that is not yet finished. The events that took place some 2,000 years ago were simply a foreshadowing of similar events, even more dramatic in nature, that will take place in the future and possibly very soon. The title of the sermon this afternoon is The Feast of Dedication. Now, to set the stage, we have to go back quite a bit in history and just review quickly. We know that God rescued the descendants of Jacob. That is, he is, of course, Abraham's grandson. He rescued the descendants of Jacob, or Israel, from the nation of Egypt. By God's hand, some 400 years prior to that, Joseph, through a series of events and circumstances, had become the second most powerful man in the nation of Egypt, which at the time was the most powerful nation on earth. Over a period of about 400 years, after Joseph's time, after Jacob's time, the nation, or the people of Israel, the tribes of Israel, grew into really the size of a nation. And they were inside or within Egypt. The people of Egypt, of course, felt threatened by Israel. And they began to enslave them in a very harsh and difficult living situation. And we know that by a series of miracles, God rescued Israel from Egypt and brought Israel into the land that he had promised to Abraham's descendants. But they failed as a nation because they refused to honor the covenant that they had entered into with God. They turned instead to other gods, the pagan gods of the nations around them, and they turned their back on the God, the true God, who had rescued them. Eventually, because of their sins, they were divided into two nations, the nation of Judah and the second nation, which maintained the name Israel. However, both nations, even after that separation and division, continued to reject God. And after several hundred more years, they each went into captivity. Israel, the northernmost nation, was the first to be taken captive. They were destroyed by the Assyrians in the early 700s BC. The southern nation of Judah began to crumble due to a series of sieges, which began about 114 years after Israel's collapse and concluded in 604 BC. I'm sorry, concluded in 585 BC, when the city of Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple that Solomon had built was destroyed, and the last of the people of Judah were carried captive into Babylon. Again in 585 BC. Now, some of the history of Judah is preserved, some of the history of Judah after this captivity is preserved in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. These two books tell the story of the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the temple. A couple of the minor prophets were also written during that general time frame, Zechariah and Haggai. These books, Ezra and Nehemiah, bring us forward in the history of Judah to about the year 440 BC. And it's also clear from the content, the themes in the book of Malachi, that Malachi was also a contemporary of Nehemiah. And the book of Malachi was probably completed in about the year 450. BC. All right, so there's your 25-cent thumbnail sketch of the history of Israel. And in the entire Old Testament, from Genesis 12 to Malachi 4. But the reason I take a few moments to set the stage in that general way is to point out that when the Old Testament ends, at about 450 BC, there are about 450 years still to go before Jesus Christ is born. And there's no biblical history of what happened during that time. Biblical history ends with Ezra and Nehemiah in the mid-400s B.C. However, there's something that's interesting that we can note. The Bible does not preserve the history of Judah or Israel during that period of time. However, we do find in the Old Testament prophecies that were given hundreds of years before that gap started, which do relate some important events that would take place during the time between Malachi and Matthew. In other words, it's not history as it's presented to us. It's presented to us as prophecy. But now it's prophecy that's been fulfilled. And so we do have, through these fulfilled prophecies, some history of at least one major important event that occurred during that period of time. And as I've already mentioned, those prophecies not only applied to the period of time that took place between the end of the Old Testament and the birth of Jesus Christ, but they also project to the end times of the age. So let's review this particular prophecy that I'm speaking about. And as we do that, we'll also find some of the background for the celebration of the Festival of Lights, the Festival of Dedication, or Hanukkah. Turn back with me to Daniel chapter 8. Here's where we find a vision that was given to Daniel that will relate to the time frame that we're going to talk about today. Daniel chapter 8. And we begin in verse 1. Daniel chapter 8, verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. In other words, this is another vision that appeared to Daniel, and it came to him in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. Now, secular history would help us understand that the third year of King Belshazzar would have been 548 B.C. 548 B.C. was when this prophecy was, or this vision was given to Daniel. Now, I will mention something. I'm going to talk about some dates. I'm not going to load you up with a lot of detail and a lot of dates because that gets confusing. But there, obviously, you're talking about history. There'll be some dates that we'll mention and talk about. If you read another source, and I've mentioned this before, you may find that the date given for a particular event is a year or two different than what I might mention today. I think that it's within the range of plus or minus. It's an acceptable range or difference. So if you have an inspired note in your margin that says this was 550 or 547, let's agree that we're in the ballpark on these dates. Now, there are some dates that are hard dates or specific dates, but there are others where we aren't, don't have to be exactly precise. But this prophecy, this vision, best guess would be that it was given to Daniel in 548. Now, you glance down here, it starts talking about a ram and a he-goat, and they're fighting and smiting one another. Let's cheat a little bit. Let's go ahead to verse 20. Verses 20 and 21 are kind of the key to this vision. They let us know Daniel, after he saw this vision, was himself confused, and he asked for more clarity. And so this explanation, at least this much of an explanation, was given to him. So in verse 20, we read that the ram, which you saw, having two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. So that's kind of the answer to the question that we're about to get to, which is begins in verse 3. Let's go back now to verse 3. Daniel, in this vision, says, I lifted up my eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. So this is a description of the forming of the empire of Medo-Persia. There were two kings, as is mentioned here. One was more dominant than the other, but they came up together, and they formed this nation, or this empire, the Medo-Persians. Verse 4, I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. That's simply a summary of the development of this empire, that it conquered those nations around them, and as they went forward to build their empire. And so they became great, and there was no nation that could stand against them. This is the empire of the Medes and Persians. Now you recall, in Daniel chapter 2, the four world-ruling or world-dominating empires that are described by the image that is portrayed there. The second one is the Medes and Persians. And that empire dominated between the years of 558 and 331 B.C. It succeeded, it followed the nation of Babylon. Now let's go back to verse 21. We know who the ram is. The ram is the nation of Medo-Persia. Verse 21, the rough goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So now we have the answer to the next question, as we see in verse 5. After the ram had conquered, now verse 5, I was considering, behold, an he-goat, I'm reading from the King James, came from the west over the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now, not touching the ground implies this goat, that's the symbolic of the nation, moving very quickly. It was going at a rapid pace, as if it didn't even touch the ground. It was moving so fast. Verse 6, this he-goat with the notable horn between his eyes came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close to the ram, and was moved with anger against him, and he smote the ram and broke the ram's two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. So this, then, is a description of the rapid development of the next world-dominating empire following Medo-Persia, which, of course, is the kingdom of Greece. And its notable horn between his eyes, or its first king, as it's described in verse 21, is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great swiftly conquered all the other nations. He defeated the Medes and Persians, who before that time were by far the strongest military in the region and in the area. The great and notable horn, of course, is again, or the great horn between his eyes is Alexander, represents Alexander himself. Verse 8 says, therefore, the he-goat, or the Greek Empire, grew very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. While Alexander the Great was still very young, and while he was still very powerful, he died unexpectedly. And that's what this prophecy indicates. While he was still strong, that horn was broken. And for it, or in place of it, came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, these that are mentioned in verse 8 are also described key here. Look over to verse 22. Verse 21 described Greece as this great goat, and Alexander the Great was the first king. Verse 22, now that being broken, in other words, again, Alexander having died, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. Four others, we took four to replace one. These four who took the place of Alexander the Great at his death were his four leading generals. And the empire was divided between them, and it continued for quite some time after that, but it never really had the power and the strength that it had under Alexander the Great. This Greek empire continued from about 331 when Alexander the Great began his conquests to the year 33 BC when the Roman Empire emerged. So these four kings continued then for another, 300 years. Not them in particular, but the governments that they represent. So we have quite a development here, and in terms of the vision that Daniel sees, prophesying both the Medo-Persian and Greek empires. So we've already kind of thrown quite a few dates out here, but so let's quickly summarize. Where are we as we get to this period of the Greek Empire? Remember that Judah had gone into captivity between the years 604 and 585. Daniel's vision here in chapter 8 was given in 548, some 40 years after Judah's captivity had begun. Daniel's vision prophesied the Medo-Persian Empire, which history confirms dominated the scene or the area of the world from 538 to 331 BC. Now, remember that the historical record of the Old Testament ends at about 450 BC. So that means that this Medo-Persian Empire continued into the time following the close of the historic books of the Old Testament. It was about 100 years after the last Old Testament book was written. It was about 100 years after that Alexander the Great began his military conquest. And that also was 217 years after Daniel's vision. The vision was in 548. So it was 217 years later that the prophecies about Alexander and his early death and the others taking his place, that those prophecies were fulfilled. Now you're aware, I'm sure, that many critics deny the visions and the prophecies of Daniel. They look at these and they say, look, it's just too detailed. Nobody could have predicted these things. It had to have been written after the fact. They deny the vision and the power of God by assuming that somebody, after all these events had already taken place, must have gone back and written about it as if it had been a vision. Of course, we understand that God truly did give this vision and other prophecies to Daniel. So we've come to the point in about the year 323 where Alexander the Great dies and four generals divide the nation between them. The four notable ones mentioned in Daniel 8, verse 8. Now, there's a lot of detail. We could talk about exactly their names and what region of the empire that they had authority responsibility for and how they developed over time. But we're not going to get into a lot of detail. I want to keep it kind of on a block outline level in one sense and focus on specific prophecies that have to do with the fulfillment of, or that led up to the time that is marked by Hanukkah. So in verse 9, Daniel 8, verse 9, out of one of them, that is, out of one of the four generals who had taken control of the empire, out of one of them came forth a little horn, which grew exceedingly great. Now, Alexander the Great was a notable horn. He was a very powerful and strong personality and leader. This is a little horn. This is someone not up to the quality or level of Alexander the Great. But he did grow strong. And he worked toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Now, from a geographical perspective, we see that this king has his authority and power in the north, and he extends that toward the south and toward the east. It is this little horn, we're not going to get into it in any detail, but this is the line of kings that is identified in the book of Daniel as the king of the north. He is in the north, and he's working to the south and to the east, and toward the pleasant land, which is Judea. And it grew great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. About 150 years after the four-way division of the Greek Empire, a man named Antiochus IV Epiphanes emerged as the king of Syria. He is the little horn that is mentioned here in verse 9. The area he controlled spread from the north to the south and east and eventually encompassed Judea. Antiochus Epiphanes was powerful and he was brutal. Again, he's the king of Syria, and he's wanting to expand his area of control. Antiochus Epiphanes is considered one of the most cruel tyrants during this period of history. And this was a time when there were a lot of cruel guys out there. Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the worst. In 168 B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes invaded Judea. He spread to the pleasant land. Now, prior to that time, from the time of Alexander's death to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the people of Judah had been left alone. No one really bothered them. They were left to practice their religion, practice their culture. They were not really an autonomous nation, but they lived at peace, and the other rulers in the area just let them be. But Antiochus Epiphanes changed all that. Some historical records show that perhaps as many as 80,000 Jews were killed or taken into slavery when Antiochus Epiphanes invaded the area of Judea. His purpose was to stamp out anything and everything Jewish, their religion, their culture, everything about them he intended to destroy and to absorb them into the Greek religion and the Greek culture. There really was no one specific Greek religion. They worshipped a whole host of different pagan gods, but he wanted to break them away from the religion that they practiced, the god that they worshipped. There's no doubt that this was a direct attempt by Satan to defeat God's plan. His idea was, if I can destroy the nation of Judah, then God's plan will be ground to a halt. Clearly, that was what Satan intended to do through Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, verse 10 here is a bit difficult to understand. It speaks of the host of heaven being cast down and so on. This seems to be descriptive or symbolic language describing the brutal and cruel ways that Antiochus trampled the people of Judah, torturing them and pressuring them on so many different levels to attempt to get them to give up worshiping their God and to accept the pagan Greek religions. For example, the Jews were forbidden from practicing their religion at all. They were under the penalty of death if they were caught observing the Sabbath day. They were under the penalty of death if they attempted to observe the holy days. They were also under the penalty of death if a copy of the book of the law was found in their possession, or even if they circumcised their baby boys. In these and in other ways, Antiochus trampled the faithful people of God. Of course, some did give in to this kind of pressure. Probably knowing human nature, there are some who just were drawn to the Greek culture. Some of the Jews just decided that that's the way they wanted to live. Others of them, we know, gave in to the pressures to modify their beliefs and practices in an effort to protect themselves or to protect their families. The details of what was done are really too grim, too gruesome to even speak about. I'm not going to go into those details. If you would be interested, you could read the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees and the Apocrypha. It's a couple of historic books that relate some of the history of what happened and how the people of Judah were treated so brutally at the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes. So some did give in to try to protect themselves and their families from these horrible experiences. But of course, others stood strong and were faithful to God. Countless faithful Jews suffered gruesome and violent martyrdom. Continue in verse 11, it says, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. In other words, this man, Antiochus Epiphanes, who is being prophesied here, and that prophecy was fulfilled by him in the 160s BC, he considered himself to be a god. Not really unusual among the pagan kings. Even some of the Caesars claimed to be God. And this was something that he felt of himself as well. He magnified himself as the prince of the host. Again, this reflects the attitude of Lucifer, who attempted to exalt himself above God. And by him, the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. In the winter of 167 BC, after having invaded and sacking the city of Jerusalem, Antiochus took control of the temple, and he prevented the Jews from offering their sacrifices on the altar. He defiled the temple by placing a statue of Zeus, the most powerful king in the Greek pagan hierarchy, placed a statue of Zeus at the altar. And as an intentional and total insult to the Jews, he had pigs sacrificed on their sacred altar. Certainly, other than the destruction of Solomon's temple, which had taken place over 400 years earlier, this was one of the darkest times to this point in the history of Judah. Verse 12. Mostly I'm reading from the King James. I'll read this verse from the New King James. It says, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices. And he cast down, he cast truth to the ground. He did all this and prospered. He was given or allowed to have an army which opposed everything that was right. The truth itself of God was cast to the ground and trampled along with the people. It says that he did all this and he prospered. That's one of the most frustrating things for us to observe, isn't it? When someone that we know is evil and sinful and godless, and yet he seems to prosper in what he's doing. You see, for the time being, God allowed Antiochus Epiphanes, who was nothing more than an instrument of Satan, to get away with all of these atrocities. And we'll see in just a moment that for 3 years, Antiochus was successful. And the worship of God was forbidden in the very temple of God, in the very city of God. The temple was defiled. It became a pagan temple. The people who were experiencing this, obviously, were devastated, and they wanted to know. In fact, this really is Daniel responding to what he's seeing, verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking. In other words, the two angels who are conversing that Daniel overheard. And one asked, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary will be cleansed. So the circumstance would continue, according to this prophecy, for 2,300 days. Now, the phrase 2,300 days would be better translated 2,300 mornings and evenings would be the better translation of that phrase. In other words, remember that there were two sacrifices that were given at the altar at the temple every day, the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice, one given early in the day and one given late afternoon at about dusk. So there were 2,300 morning and evening sacrifices, which would literally be a period of 1,150 days, which is approximately just slightly more than 3 years. I'm sure that parts of these stories, and maybe the entire story, is something that is familiar. And as we follow this story through, we see how it merges into the event that the Jewish people have just recently celebrated. See, during this time, during the 3 years that Antiochus Epiphanes was trampling the people of God in Judah and at the temple, during that time, in the mountains northwest of Jerusalem, a popular revolt began to come together. A revolt against the Syrians. In the small village of Modin, an elderly priest named Matthias took a stand against the pagans. As a priest, he was required to offer a pagan sacrifice. And as he was faced with that requirement, rather than doing so, he killed, first of all, a fellow Jew who was with him, who was compromising and offering the pagan sacrifice. And he also killed one of the king's representatives who was sent to monitor that area. And in addition, he tore down the pagan altar where these sacrifices were being made. Now, having killed the Jewish collaborator and the king's representative and tearing down the altar, he fled. He had 5 sons, and they all left together. They all fled to the hills together. There were other faithful Jews who, of course, heard what he had done, and they began to rally to his cause and to his support. This small band grew over time, but it was never very large, and they waged a guerrilla-style warfare against the powerful Syrian army. They were almost like terrorists, the small groups and bands who could move quickly and strike with surprise. And they had the Syrians generally on the run because of the kind of war that they were fighting, that they were battling. Josephus, the historian, records in one of his books that Antiochus put together an army of 50,000 foot soldiers to go try to track down these little bands of guerrilla warriors. But of course, being much smaller, quicker, easier to maneuver, they were never able to track them down. Now, during this war, Matthias died. Not sure how he died. It does not seem that he died in battle. He was already an older man. And so it was during this period of time that he died. And his third oldest son, a man named Judas, assumed responsibility for leading this little band, this little army of guerrilla or terrorists. Judas proved to be a very skilled strategist. He was able to put together plans of attack that were very effective, and he was himself individually a very fierce warrior. And this earned him the nickname, the Hammer. Now, I don't watch wrestling on television, but I've got to guess that there must be somebody out there in this wrestling mania world who's called the Hammer. I'm just guessing. But at any rate, this was Judas's nickname. He was called the Hammer because of his fierce warrior character and personality. Now, the Hebrew word for hammer is Maccabeus. Judas's nickname transferred to this entire family of priests, Judas and his other now four brothers who headed it up, and their armies, and they became known as the Maccabeans. And this family, Judas and his brothers, led the Jews in a war that is called the Maccabean Revolt. Again, they were so successful in their attacks on the Syrian armies, even though they had vast superiority in numbers and probably in equipment, maybe even in training, but this small band of Maccabees was so successful that 3 years later, in December of 164, the Maccabees succeeded in recapturing the temple and retaking the city of Jerusalem. And they evicted the Syrians. Having won this victory, Judas Maccabeus, who was a priest, ordered the loyal priests in Jerusalem, who had not collaborated with Antiochus, to cleanse the temple and to build a new altar. 3 years after Antiochus had defiled the temple. 1,150 days, 2,300 morning and evening sacrifices later, the Jews were able to once again worship their God in peace. Now, it was through this victory that the people of Judah and the religion of Judaism were preserved in the early 160s B.C. And this set the stage for the first coming of Jesus Christ, which would take place about 160 years later. Had Antiochus Epiphanes been successful, had the people of Judah been destroyed, had the religion of Judaism been wiped out, then the course of God's plan would have certainly been interrupted. But it was not to be allowed. But you see, this was all prophesied in Daniel's vision. And it took place some 300 years after he had been given that vision. Now, according to Jewish tradition, and this is something that many of us are familiar with, according to the Jewish tradition, when it was time to rededicate the cleansed temple and the new altar, the priests found that there was only one container of oil available that was undefiled, that could be used in the lamps, used in the lampstand, which was to be kept burning at all times in the temple. Exodus chapter 27, verse 20. We might as well quickly turn there. Exodus 27, verse 20 is the instruction that only a particular kind of oil, very carefully prepared, was allowed to be used in this lampstand. Exodus 27, verse 20. You shall command the children of Israel that they bring you pure olive oil, beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn always in the tabernacle of the congregation outside the veil. So there was a particular recipe or formula which was necessary to make the oil that was used in that lampstand, which was to be kept burning perpetually. The word beaten here that's used, again, I'm reading from the King James. I think it says carefully prepared or something to that effect in the New King James. But the word beaten means to carefully and thoroughly refine and purify. So, again, it was a very sacred kind of fuel that was used to be used in these lamps. It wasn't just something they could, it wasn't a generic kind of lamp oil. Something that took time and care to prepare. And it took a week of careful work and preparation to make the oil that could be used in the lamps. But again, there was only enough oil on hand to burn for one day. Miraculously, the flame of the lamp continued for 8 days, which was long enough for a new supply of oil to be prepared for the holy use in the lamp. So in commemoration of these events that took place in 164 B.C., who actually started in 167 when the altar was first abominated or desecrated, and concluded 3 years later in December 164, followed by the cleansing of the temple and the altar a new altar being established. This is the reason. And then, of course, the lamp, the oil that miraculously burned until new oil could be prepared. These are the events that are commemorated by the Festival of Lights, having to do, of course, with the lamp, or the Festival of our Feast of Dedication, referring to the dedication of the altar. It's a national celebration of deliverance from the oppression of King Antiochus. During these 8 days of Hanukkah, there's a blessing, a particular blessing that is asked over the candles each night as each new day begins at sunset or at dark. A particular blessing is asked over the candles as a part of their tradition. Here's the blessing. It says, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who wrought miracles for our fathers in days of old." Simple statement, but it acknowledges that God is the one who provided for his people on many occasions, including in this very tragic in one sense, but on the other hand, a day of great victory that was won in the time of the 160s B.C. So how is this relevant to us? What does this mean to us? That the Jews had this experience in their history and they worship or they remember or honor those days? Well, I think it's pretty clear. Turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 15. Jesus, of course, had been asked just shortly before this to answer the question of what would be the sign of his coming and of the end of the age. He began with the general description that you find in the preceding several verses. Then we come to verse 12, which is part of the description that he gives of the events that would occur at the end of the age. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoever reads, let him understand. We'll pause there for just a moment. That parenthetical thought about understanding is very important. See, there will be a number of events that will take place at the end of the age. But it's not going to be necessarily just exactly obvious to everyone what is happening. There needs to be a level of or degree of understanding when certain events take place. And we know that those people who are faithful disciples of Jesus Christ will have the understanding that will be necessary. So he says, when you see that, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not come down and take anything out of his house, neither let him who is in the field return back to take his clothes. See, the point that Jesus is making here is that when that event happens again, we saw that it happened 167 to 164 BC. But when it happens again, it is the starting point for the most significant events in the history of God's people, of God's nation. And he said, to those who are in the immediate area, those in Judea, they're told to flee to the mountains. Now, again, we could add more detail to this. We could go back to Revelation. Or even refer to Luke 21, where Jesus talks about being able to escape the things that are to come. We know that those outside of Judea, those in God's church in general, will be given the opportunity for protection and for nourishment in a wilderness place. But those that are in Judea, where this is actually taking place, are told to flee to the mountains. Otherwise, he says, don't come down into your house. Don't try to gather up things that you want to have with. In other words, it's when this happens, when this event takes place, it's too late to prepare. It's time to move. It's time to understand, and it's time to take the correct action. You know, there are a lot of people who seem to make the mistake that, well, I'll just kind of keep an eye on the Middle East, and I'll just kind of keep an eye on certain people, and when things start looking hostile or bad or dangerous, I'll jump back into the church. No, it doesn't work that way. Those who are not prepared, it's like the 10 virgins. 5 were wise, 5 were foolish, 5 were prepared, 5 were not. When this event takes place again, it's time for action. Now, it's one thing to look back and to celebrate and to get excited about what happened to the Jews in the 160s BC. That's a part of history. It's an interesting story. But the importance of that is that it's not over yet. Jesus said it's going to happen again. And we better be prepared for it. Verse 21, for then there shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. As awful as things were for the Jews in Jerusalem at the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes, nothing compared to what is coming. Nothing like this has ever happened before. So we see a much greater significance and importance to the history of Hanukkah, the 8 days of the candles burning. It was a miracle. God did intervene. God saved the nation of Judah from the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes. But as he did so, He was also in these prophecies alerting his people at the end of the age that it's not over yet. Back to Daniel 8 again. Daniel 8. We've read most of the chapter. I want to move on now to verse 23. We've seen the ram and the goat and the Alexander the Great and the four kings, that four generals who divided the kingdom, and the little horn, Antiochus Epiphanes, the desecration of the temple for about 3 years. But verse 23 takes it again to the next level. It says, in the latter time of their kingdom. So now it's a fast forward to the latter days, to the end of the age. This prophecy is not just for events that took place between Malachi and Matthew. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. This is describing another evil, godless ruler, similar to Antiochus Epiphanes, coming at a later time period. He will rise to power. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. In Revelation 13, it talks about the beast and how it is powered by Satan, the devil himself. He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper. Yeah, just like the first one. God will allow him the freedom to fulfill this part. Frankly, it's part of God's plan that this would take place. But he'll succeed for a while. He will continue and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. So again, it's speaking of a time of great, serious persecution that will come upon the people of God in the latter days at the end of the age. And through his policy, he shall cause deceit to prosper in his hand. He'll magnify himself in his heart. Again, as was done in the case of the first man, the first of the little horn, he'll magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. Seems that this person will take his position of authority, seemingly as a peaceful leader initially, but then turn violent against God's people. He will stand up against the prince of princes. In other words, this is the one who will stand against Jesus Christ when he returns. But he shall be broken without hand. He will not ultimately succeed any more than what happened the first time around. History is an interesting thing. History, in many cases, in God's word, turns out to be prophecy. Turns out to be an indication not only just of something that has happened, but a foreshadowing of what is yet to come about. Let's conclude by kind of summarizing a bit. What are some key points that we can remember from having studied this period of time? Some of these are general, but I think we can learn some important principles from studying these events. First of all, we see that fulfilled prophecy is a proof of God and his authority. The prophecies that were made by Daniel here in the 540s BC took place hundreds of years later in their initial fulfillment and will yet again be fulfilled at the end of the age, as Jesus mentioned in Matthew 24. It's proof that God's ultimate authority and command over his plan. This also should strengthen our confidence in the fulfillment of prophecies that are still to come. A second general point that we can emphasize from this story is that although he tries, Satan cannot defeat God's plan. He has lifted his hand against God from the beginning. As Lucifer, he rebelled and tried to overtake God's throne. He was in the Garden of Eden to try to destroy mankind from the very beginning. He's made other specific efforts to destroy God's plan. For example, in the time of Esther, he was responsible for a plot that was set up to destroy the entire nation of Judah. But God, through Esther and her uncle Mordecai, thwarted that plan. Another attempt to cut off the people of God. After Jesus was born, what did Satan do? He got into Herod's head and convinced him to kill all the babies in the land, all the boys, two years of age and under. Satan was trying to kill the Messiah as a little tiny infant. Of course, God, smarter than that, he got Joseph and Mary and Jesus to head over to Egypt and just hang out there until Herod died. But Satan is continually trying to defeat God. He's not through yet. But at every turn, God not only defeats Satan's efforts, but he uses Satan's efforts to further his own plan. Third, we also see from the history an example of how people respond to intense persecution. This is something that might cause us to pause and to consider. There were those in the time of 160s BC who were strong, who were faithful to the death, who stood for what they believed, and they were not going to compromise. You know, it's easy to compromise. You can reason and rationalize. Why should I be martyred or my family be tortured when all I have to do is once a year offer a pig on an altar? I don't even believe in it. I'll just do it just to satisfy them. People reason that way pretty quickly and pretty easily, don't they? Some were weak and fearful and willing to compromise. Some were brave and faithful to the death. We know that at the time of the end of the age, there will be another time of great persecution. Will that be during our lifetime? We don't know. But we certainly should understand the prophecy that these things will come about. One other point we just make very in a general sense, and I didn't read this. Let's go to John chapter 10. This is the verse where we find reference to Jesus being in Jerusalem at the time of the Feast of Dedication. John chapter 10, verse 22. It just says it was at Jerusalem, the Feast of the Dedication, and it was winter. Well, we just passed through the period of Hanukkah, and take a look outside. It is winter. Now, this year on the Jewish calendar is unique. All of the Jewish calendar, everything that's on the calendar in the Jewish is earlier in the year than it has ever been. We noted that when we observed the holy days, especially the fall. We don't. How often do we observe the Feast of Trumpets on September the 5th? And the Feast of Tabernacles concluded by the middle of September. The cycle of the calendar and the way all the dates fall, things are earlier this year than they will be again for something like 70,000 years. It's just virtually a unique year in terms of the calendar. Now, in Jesus' time, in 31 A.D., this would have been January or the winter of 31 A.D., just the season before Jesus was crucified. And at that time, that year, Hanukkah would have fallen probably in early January. So yeah, it was winter in Jerusalem when Jesus was there on that occasion. Now, Jesus does not give a Hanukkah message. He doesn't give anything that relates specifically to the occasion. So, I don't know that he was there to celebrate Hanukkah. He may have just been there for other reasons, or he may have gone to be with some family as they were observing it. It would have been nothing wrong with observing it, but we have now considered the origin of that celebration. But we do see something interesting in the context here. John chapter 10 is one of the most inspiring and encouraging of the chapters about Jesus Christ. This is where he describes himself as the good shepherd, as the one who lays down his life for his sheep. He promises that his sheep hear his voice and recognize him and follow him and are secure and taken care of. He promises us in the context of this chapter, which is during the time of the dedication, during the time of Hanukkah. He makes the promise to us that no one can snatch us out of his hand, and no one can snatch us out of the Father's hand. He offers us great encouragement and a promise of an enduring relationship, that he will see us through to the kingdom, is the message that Jesus wraps around this context of the Feast of Dedication. So as we look at it from this historical point of view, we find that certainly this is an important lesson from history. We see in it God's power, God's authority, God's love to complete for his people, to complete his plan, and to see it through to its successful conclusion. It's good to have the background, the understanding of the origin of this particular event or celebration. But it's even more important to see the reminder that this prophecy is not yet completely fulfilled, so that we are reminded to put our trust and our faith in God to complete his plan and to deliver us to his kingdom.